The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I'll call our third case of the day, Security Finance versus Kirsch. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Please do.
May it please the court, I am attorney Brian Pagel of Lawton & Cates. I represent defendant petitioner Brian Kirsch in this matter. Your honors, creditors, like any person, cannot be allowed to simply break the law, say I'm sorry, and proceed as though the illegal violation had never happened. We're here today because that is what Security Finance wants you ultimately to hold, is that it need not comply with long-standing provisions of law that were negotiated by and implemented by merchants such as Security Finance in a trade-off between merchants and customers to make Wisconsin one of the states that protects consumer rights the most in our entire country.
Counsel, I'm wondering if your claim for damages under 425.302 is properly before us. The reason I ask is I read your petition for review. At page 2, it says, the sole issue on this appeal is whether a debtor can sue for damages under Chapter 427 of the Wisconsin Consumer Act.
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that is the sole issue on appeal as we presented to this court. Section 425.302 is primarily referenced in our brief as a mechanism by which this court may enforce the statutes under 427.104.
But the damages under Chapter 425 are different from the damages under 427, correct?
The violation, if brought solely under Chapter 425.302, would be different than those available under 427.104.
So how do you, for a violation of Chapter 427, how do you access the damages provided for in 425 when you said in your petition that the only issue is whether you can sue for damages under Chapter 427?
I think that the damages under Chapter 427, specifically 427.104, would encompass the same damages under 425.302. Read properly, Chapter 425, Section 425.302, is a statute that ensures that consumers have a right to bring an action when a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act has ensued or has occurred, and 427.104 is the primary mechanism by which that can be enforced, and that is, in fact, the mechanism Mr. Kirsch is seeking to enforce here.
But doesn't Chapter 425 have an entirely different set of responsibilities, the violation of which would give rise to damages under Chapter 425?
There are various sections under Chapter 425 that might allow for penalties to be imposed for a violation of a specific statute, but the involved here do not set forth any specific penalty. We're concerned primarily with here Sections 425, 103, 104, and 105, which govern when a notice of right to cure default must be given and also provide the effect of failing to comply with the notice of right to cure default statute.
Is there any text in Chapter 425 that says that it exists, at least in part, for the purposes of enforcing the requirements of Chapter 427?
Chapter 425 has no section that exists to enforce Chapter 427, if I'm understanding the question correctly. Chapter 427, rather, is the mechanism by which violations of the Wisconsin Consumer Act may be enforced. When you refer to Chapter 427 specifically, Section 427.104 provides a laundry list of broad-based claims that consumers can bring for violations in the process of debt collection, such as this. And the two primary provisions, in fact, the one primary provision that Mr. Kirsch is focused on is 427.104 sub 1 sub J, which prohibits any creditor or merchant in the act of collecting a debt arising from a consumer credit transaction from claiming or threatening to enforce a right with reason to know that right doesn't exist. So Mr. Kirsch's argument here is that by demanding the accelerated payment of $1,200 and some dollars, and by filing and serving him with a lawsuit, Security Finance has in fact claimed two rights. The first, to demand the full accelerated payment before all payments had come due. And second, the right to file a lawsuit and serve him with that and require him to respond in court. Both of those rights do not exist because in this case, Security Finance did not comply with the Notice of Right to Cure Default statutes. So by failing to provide a proper Notice of Right to Cure Default, Security Finance loses the right to accelerate the maturity of the transaction under 425.105 and, in fact, lacks a cause of action.
Is the failure to provide the notice of default always a violation of some provision of Chapter 427?
It's only a violation if the merchant takes an action that is then contravened or ruled out by statute. So a merchant under 425, 103, and 104 is not required to provide a notice of right to cure default or even to declare a default unless it wants to take action. 425.105 says that merchants who want to accelerate the maturity of a transaction or file a lawsuit have to provide the notice of right to cure default and wait the requisite 15 days.
Right. And if they fail to do that, that's a violation of Chapter 425, right?
That would be a violation of both Chapter 425 and a Chapter 427.104,
okay,
provided.
So what I'm trying to figure out is it when they try to enforce that debt and they don't give the notice of default, is that always a violation of both Chapter 425 and Chapter 427? Always.
I believe it would always be a violation of both of those if they either accelerate the debt without providing the notice or file a lawsuit on the debt without providing the notice. Under the circumstances as presented here, in other words, it would always be a violation of both of those provisions of the statute.
All right. And so under Chapter 427, you believe that failure to provide the notice is a violation of 427.104 sub 1 sub J. Is that right?
It is at the least a violation of that because they're claiming the right to demand an accelerated, fully mature debt when it was not yet fully due and the right to file suit when under 425.105 they lack a cause of action even. So it's not a matter of being able to file suit. It's that they do not have a cause of action. So by threatening to enforce those rights or attempting to, they are violating 427.104.1J. Under certain circumstances, they may violate other provisions of that statute, such as the ones that prohibit harassing or communicating or threatening communications. In the event that a customer actually feels harassed or a fact finder would find that the customer could feel harassed, it may violate those. But at the very least, it would always violate 427.104.1J. And that is leading into the next point. That's not a novel conclusion on the part of this court or anything new. As most of the briefing has focused on, Kett versus Community Credit some 20 years ago found that by filing an action in violation of the venue statute, other sections of the Consumer Act had likewise been violated. So 427.104.1J was violated by those creditors when they filed in Milwaukee County. And what happened in Kett was very similar to what happened here. When called on the carpet, as it were, by the consumers, the merchant attempted to voluntarily dismiss the complaint. The circuit court complied with that, and although initially the creditors felt as though they had avoided any liability, this court ultimately held that the consumers had the right to sue under Section 427.104.1J for that violation. And Kett did not stand alone. As we pointed out in our briefing, Chapter 427, from its earliest inception, codified what courts believed and the legislature believed should be the duty of care for merchants and creditors and debt collectors enforcing these laws. And I'm going to drop back again to the primary point I want this court to keep in mind is that these were not a set of laws that the legislature imposed on creditors by fiat, as it were. These were laws that were helped in part to be drafted by merchants. Merchants agreed to comply with these laws to put all merchants on an even playing field and put all merchants on the same field, and to further the provisions that they wanted, which were that they wanted to keep increased interest rates and have smoother dealings with consumers. In exchange, consumers bargained for and obtained from the agreements and ultimately the legislature the right to try to avoid threatening and harassing creditor actions such as this and the right to correct problems before they went to court. So going all the way back to Associated Financial Services versus Hornick, This court has said Chapter 427 stands in for what creditors owe to consumers. And in cases following that, such as the Zehetner case, Zehetner versus Chrysler, this court emphasized that it is a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act to demand money from a consumer when that consumer had no obligation to pay. Now, in Zehetner, the facts of the case were that the consumer there, although on the application, had never actually signed the note, and so had not become indebted to the creditor, who was then seeking to compel her to pay. While factually distinct from Mr. Kirsch's situation, legally, there is no difference between the two, because under the law here, Section 425.105 says that security finance may not accelerate the maturity of Mr. Kirsch's debt without sending him a proper notice of right to cure default. And that's exactly what security finance did. So when they filed their complaint seeking the $1,200 in damages, they demanded money that Mr. Kirsch was not legally required to pay. Even absent the filing of a lawsuit, that demand in and of itself violated Chapter 427.104. The filing of the lawsuit and the subsequent service upon it of Mr. Kirsch of that lawsuit only exacerbated a violation that occurred when security finance first demanded an amount that was well beyond what Mr. Kirsch was entitled to pay under his note. And that is the same kind of action that this court has over and over found violates Chapter 427 and allows for lawsuits
where,
under Chapter 427.
Where in 427 specifically do you find, or in 425, if you want to rely on that, do you find that failing to give notice of right to cure creates a cause of action for the debtor?
So as I noted, Your Honor, Chapter 427 codifies the obligations a creditor owes, and Section 427.104 sets out a general list of broad-based violations that can occur. So under 427.104.1J...
You can have obligations, though, of a creditor that don't equate to a claim on behalf of a debtor, and that's what I'm having a little trouble with in your argument.
Well, we believe that the claim exists on behalf of the debtor under Section 427.104.1J, where the law prohibits a creditor or merchant from claiming a right that has no, that does not exist, where the creditor has reason to know the right does not exist. So anytime a creditor, in reaction to a consumer or debtor, would claim or threaten to enforce a non-existent right, a debtor would have the right to bring an action under Chapter 427.
Right, but we're talking about the failure of the creditor to give a notice of right to cure. Where does that failure by a creditor turn into a claim by the debtor?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, the failure by the creditor prevents the creditor under Section 425.105 from accelerating the maturity of the transaction. That's the first violation security finance had here. Mr. Kirsch had a right under the contract that was appended to the complaint to make 12 equal payments over a year, once each month. When he was sued, that year had not expired yet, and so Mr. Kirsch was not required to have paid the contract in full. The complaint demanded the contract be paid in full, so that accelerated the maturity of the debt. 425.105 says merchants may not do that, so when they demanded the $1,200, they threatened or tried to enforce a right to full payment when that right did not yet exist.
Okay, but what I'm looking at is the notice of default and right to cure, that in and of itself, let's just stop with that, does not create a claim on behalf of the debtor. Is that correct? And if I'm wrong, tell me why. And I just want you to stop right there because you want to put everything all together and that doesn't help me figure this out.
If a merchant... It's not a violation of the law for a merchant not to provide a notice of right to cure default unless the merchant wants to enforce the transaction in one of the ways allowed by Chapter 425. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
To some degree, you're appending to it unless the merchant wants to enforce the amount that's claimed. But here the complaint was dismissed because it was determined to be a claim that was not valid under the facts. Why is that not sufficient? Why is there then a cause of action in addition to that on behalf of the debtor?
Well, if the only remedy a debtor has under the Consumer Act is to a dismissal of the complaint under these circumstances, then the debtor really has no remedy whatsoever.
That was the only harm, was to accelerate the debt, and if that's taken away, Why does he need a cause of action?
Well, that was not the only harm necessarily. Mr. Kirsch alleged here that he was damaged financially and emotionally by the filing of the lawsuit against him. And so what happens here is I can see that the court appears skeptical of that.
Well, you know, if everybody got damaged every time a lawsuit was filed, we'd just have personal injury folks lying everywhere. So that's a tough claim to make. You can make it, but it's tough to get there.
Well, under the facts of this case, Mr. Kirsch has to be presumed to have suffered those damages. And I understand that probably everybody feels damaged when they were sued, but what everybody lacks is a statutory mechanism to redress those grievances. Chapter 427 is a specific right that rests in the consumers to countersue or file a new action against a creditor who violates that chapter. And so where a consumer can prove that a creditor has threatened or enforced an action, a right with reason to know it doesn't exist, the consumer then has an action for damages, which explicitly includes emotional distress damages for the filing of a lawsuit.
Did you have to put up proof that the creditor had knowledge, that it had no right to accelerate the debt and give notice or right to cure at the point when it did that?
You would have to prove that the creditor had reason to know the right did not exist. That's part of Section 427.104.
Yeah, I know. I see that. And that, to me, sounds like negligence lingo. It doesn't sound like intentional conduct, right?
I would agree with the court that negligent conduct could very well be the basis for a claim under Chapter 427.
Okay. Yes. So you're not alleging that the creditor knew and for whatever reason decided to go forward and mount a claim for what they thought they were owed. So mistakes don't work. You're not alleging that they really knew that they didn't have this right.
What we're alleging in this specific context is that Security Finance, as a repeat litigator and as a creditor operating in Wisconsin, knew or had reason to know what Wisconsin requires of the notice of right to cure default.
They may know, but they may have goofed up on the dates for a particular debtor's time at which things were due, because you don't allege that the amount that was sought is not as part of this, what, $1,000 that he borrowed and had to pay off over a year.
Roughly $1,200, correct. Our allegation is that they illegally accelerated it. A creditor who actually did make a mistake, who knew of the law but made a mistake in some way, does have access to what we call a bona fide error defense.
Okay.
If the creditor can prove that they had some sort of procedure in place to avoid this sort of violation, they can avoid any sort of liability altogether. So there is an exit or a safe harbor, if you will, for creditors who do make an honest mistake.
Mm-hmm.
A creditor who makes an honest mistake that didn't try to avoid that would still be held liable under Chapter 427. Because we want to have our creditors trying to obey the law. We don't want to punish them if they're honestly trying to obey the law and just messed up on one occasion. But if they aren't trying to obey the law or don't have procedures or training in place to make sure they obey the law, then it's all the more urgent to use Chapter 427 as the enforcement mechanism, not just to vindicate the rights of Mr. Kirsch or other debtors who are individually harmed, but to ensure that all creditors are operating on the same basis. Because allowing Security Finance to proceed in this way, in fact, operates as a detriment.
Well, their suit was dismissed, so Security Finance is not proceeding. It's your client who's proceeding.
Well, in this specific case, one suit was dismissed. Oftentimes, these suits are not dismissed and proceed to judgment or default judgments, but other creditors who comply with the law have to wait to file a lawsuit and have the extra cost of providing the notice of right to cure default before they file their lawsuit. So we believe it presents an unfair advantage to companies like Security Finance, who operate outside of the boundaries of the law. And that's one of the things the Consumer Act is intended to do, is to use Chapter 427 to influence creditors to comply with the conduct of the law. That was in the Nicolaou case, where Chapter 427 was intended to help consumers operate as a private attorney general to induce compliance with the law. So one of the beauties of the Wisconsin Consumer Act is that it's policed and paid for by those who violate the law. If a company does not violate the law, or at least had in place procedures to avoid violating the law, they won't be penalized. If they do violate the law, then they are penalized, but they pay for that policing. And that's one of the things that Chapter 427 exists for, too. And again, if your only remedy, as the Beal Court held and as the lower courts held here, is simply to dismissal, then Mr. Kirsch gets nothing out of his response. He has to bear his own attorney's fees. He has to appear in court and have his name appear on CCAP and in public as a debtor. And then the case is dismissed, and there's nothing that would prohibit Security Finance from refiling a day later, a week later, or a month later again, without providing a notice of right to cure default.
Counsel, I understand that, the way you put this, it makes a lot of sense to want that kind of remedy, right? But we're constrained by the terms of the Act itself. And so when I look at Section 427.104, sub 1, sub J, and I query whether Security Finance had a claim in this case, it certainly appears they did. Notwithstanding the failure to give notice and get the acceleration that comes with that, they certainly had a right to collect on the past payments that did not be, that were not made, correct?
They certainly do have a right to collect on any unpaid past due installments, and they, in fact, have a right to expect repayment of the debt that they lent to Mr. Kirsch.
Right. So they did have a claim.
They had a claim to their money, but their claim in this case exceeded what they legally had a right to ask the court to do at the time they filed the suit.
And that happens, well, shall we say, frequently. Plaintiffs often demand more than they are entitled to. But they still have a claim.
Well, the difference, though, is if you, in a personal injury suit, if you demand more than you're entitled to, you may not get your damages. But here, if you demand more than you're entitled to, you've actually violated the law.
You're getting a step ahead of me there, because first I want to get established that there is a claim there, right? You might not be entitled to the entire amount that you've demanded, but you do have a claim. Right? 104 sub 1 sub J speaks to a situation in which there is no claim.
I believe that the effect of this statute would be overstated if you read it that way. Sub 1 J asks about whether a merchant is attempting to claim or threaten to enforce a right. So we're asking about what rights Security Finance claimed or threatened to enforce. In this case, the two rights Security Finance claimed were, first, the right to payment of the full $1,200 before it was all due, and second, the right to file a lawsuit. And Security Finance lacked both of those rights because, absent a properly served and legally sufficient notice of right to cure default, Security Finance may not accelerate the maturity of the transaction. So it absolutely lacked the right to demand the money that had not yet come due.
All right, so let's concentrate on the effect of that notice. So in the loan document, the loan document is provided for acceleration, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So as it stood, they had a right to accelerate, yeah?
Referring to simply under the loan document under the statute?
Yeah, I'm starting with the loan documents. Loan documents give them a right to accelerate, yeah?
The loan documents gave the Security Finance the right to accelerate as allowed by law, yes.
Okay. Now, Chapter 425 says that there are some prerequisites before you can exercise that right. But the right is still there, right?
The right would only exist if the prerequisites have been met. It's not an absolute right.
So let me pressure test that theory. So let's say the loan documents didn't say anything about acceleration, but Security Finance did give the notice of default, right?
Yes.
Would that give them a right to accelerate?
That would, because under the statute, they would have a right to accelerate.
Even without that being in the loan documents?
Even without that being in the loan documents, yes.
Counsel, as I see it, this case is really more about... Are you finished?
I am, thank you. Yes.
This case is really more about remedies and remedies to the consumer under the Wisconsin Consumer Act than it is whether or not than it is the nature of the defect in the right to cure notice.
That is correct, yes. This court has held, and the Court of Appeals has also repeatedly held, that there are no technical violations of the Consumer Act with respect to notices of this sort. That's Indian Head Motors. So the manner of the violation would maybe play into the level of damages, but the fact is that it's a strict liability statute. So the sole question for this court is whether Mr. Kirsch has a remedy beyond obtaining a dismissal without prejudice, whether Chapter 427 allows him to affirmatively claim against Security Finance for his damages and attorney's fees. If I may then to return to your question, Your Honor, you asked about whether if the right to cure or right to accelerate was not in the document, whether Security Finance would still have the right. And in other cases, the Court of Appeals has held that where a contract specifically required a step to be taken, then the creditor would violate the Consumer Act for failing to follow those steps. There was a case where the creditor was required to obtain a judgment of replevin before engaging in self-help under the contractual terms.
Yeah. Could you, and I apologize for apparently not coming across this in my preparation for the case today, but could you point me to the provision that allows the Security Finance to accelerate the loan even if that is not in the documents?
The provision of the Wisconsin Consumer Act?
Yeah.
Under 425, 103, 104, and 105, those define what a default would be, and a default would occur if Mr. Kirsch missed two or more payments within a 12-month period under this type of agreement, a consumer credit transaction. So Security Finance, once Mr. Kirsch misses those two payments, if we assume for the moment that he did, Security Finance then has the right, if they want to declare a default. They aren't required to do so. They can wait out his payments or continue to work with them.
Right, but is there something in those statutory provisions that says Security Finance, even though you don't have anything in the loan documents that says that you have the right to accelerate, you can? Is there anything like that in the statute?
You would only get that, I guess, through a negative inference. Under 425.105, it prohibits a merchant from accelerating the maturity of a consumer transaction until they send the notice of right to cure default and wait 15 days. So by inference, they would have the right to accelerate if they send the notice of right to cure default and wait 15 days. Without sending the notice of right to cure default, they lack that right, even if it's in the contract, because the Consumer Act voids any provisions of contracts which are not in compliance with its own conditions. So if Security Finance were to try and write a acceleration clause more favorable than the ones that exist in the statute, that would be an unenforceable term of the contract. They can grant more time under the contract, but cannot require less time. Does that answer the court's question?
Close enough. I think your red light's on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Lawless. And along with my colleague Marcy Koski, we represent Security Finance Corporation of Wisconsin in this case. This is a case of coming full circle for me in my career, because my first oral argument in an appeal was in the Seventh Circuit in the Fagan case, which you all discussed in your 11 o'clock hearing. I represented the publisher under my former name. Anyway, full circle. I was much younger then, but none of us look any older. So in this case, as Justice Kelly noted, the petition for review raised just one issue, whether there is a claim under 427.104 for the conduct alleged in the complaint in this case, or in the amended counterclaim in this case. I want to correct something very quickly, because it was repeated many times by defendant's counsel. The amended counterclaim does not allege a violation, or does not allege that the debt was improperly accelerated. That isn't mentioned in the amended counterclaim as a violation of 427.104.1J. It's not mentioned as some kind of violation of 425.105. Also, the response brief on our motion to dismiss the counterclaim did not raise the fact that you accelerated. Looking at your complaint, we say you accelerated the debt, and you didn't have the right to do so, and that runs afoul of 425, and it also runs afoul of 427.104. Because that was not raised in the circuit court, was not raised in response to our motion to dismiss, it cannot be a basis to reverse the circuit court's decision to dismiss the counterclaims. But even putting that aside, we still will respond to the argument substantively. In order to determine whether there's been a violation of 427.104.1J or 1G, the court needs to look at the language of the statute. There's been a lot of argument about the fact that that the lender acted unfairly, that customers need to be protected, that the Consumer Act represents an adoption of a statute that merchants and lenders had a lot of input in. In fact, the WCA represents a balancing of interests of both sides. Representatives of the merchants, lenders, representatives of consumers got together and hammered out the WCA in the 1970s, and it was implemented. I just want to give a nod to our dear colleague, Ed Heiser. He wrote the Marquette Law Review article from the 1970s on the Consumer Act, and it's often cited against us. So we want to give a nod to our colleague. 427.104. 1J, we need to look at that language to see whether, in fact, the counterclaim has stated a claim and whether, as I understand counsel's argument, any time a lender files an action and allegedly doesn't provide a proper notice of cure, whether not providing it at all or providing it before the customer was in default or perhaps not providing the 15 days to cure, or maybe even missing some information that's listed in 425.104. Anytime an action is filed when there's been a defect allegedly in the notice of cure, counsel is arguing that that is a violation of 427.104.1J. And our position, as we've shown in our brief, that conduct does not fall within 1J. The 427.104 does not establish a standard of care. And Chapter 427 does not establish regulations that the lender needs to comply with in their daily doing of business. Chapter 425 provides for procedures in the doing of business. Earlier sections of the WCA provide for disclosures. The entire WCA provides the framework under which lenders operate. 427 is rather a section related solely to improper debt collection activities. The list in 427.104.1 is a detailed list of conduct that's considered to be abusive and unfair to customers, such as threatening them with violence when you're trying to collect a debt, disclosing the existence of their debt to third parties, harassing them by repeatedly contacting them at unreasonable hours to try to collect the debt, and things like that. The language of 427.104.1 is not broad. It's specific. And in order to find a violation of that section, you need to find that the allegations, the conduct by the lender, fits within the statute.
Tell me why the asserted conduct in 425.105 does not fit within 427.104J.
Sure. Excellent question.
That's
what I was going to get to next, and I will answer your question, I think, hopefully fully. You do need to look at the two provisions together in order to determine whether the not sending a proper notice of cure or sending a defective notice of cure constitutes conduct falling within 1J. That's true. So first, if we start with 1J in 427.104, it prohibits a lender from claiming or attempting or threatening to enforce a right with knowledge or reason to know that the right does not exist. So looking at this language to see if it applies, we need to know what is the meaning of right and what does it mean to say the right does not exist. And I would direct you that you need to look at Chapter 425 under the allegations of this case to determine whether a right exists or not and what the right is. So let's go to 425.
Yeah, and it's asserted that the right that was here, they claim a right to be able to accelerate or to file a lawsuit even though the notice of cure, or the notice to cure, the right to cure, is defective. So defective ab initio. Doesn't work. It's no good, right? So under 425.105, you do not have the right to accelerate the maturity of a consumer credit transaction, and you do not have the right to commence any action without first filing a statutorily valid notice of right to cure.
And I don't agree with interpretation, but I'll explain
okay,
why.
Tell,
okay,
yeah, that's the way they're arguing
yeah,
it. But that makes sense to me. Tell me why they are
I will. So if we start with the beginning of Chapter 425. Chapter 425 is Subchapter 1, Creditor's Remedies. 425.102 provides that this subchapter applies to actions or other proceedings brought by a creditor to enforce rights arising from consumer credit transactions. And then 425.103 defines that when a cause of action under a consumer credit transaction arises, and it says that no cause of action with respect to the obligation of a customer in a consumer credit transaction shall accrue except by reason of default. Default is defined by the WCA. In this case, an installment loan, that means you have more than one monthly payment owing for more than 10 days. Then you're in default. At the moment you fall into default, the lender has a cause of action under the WCA. Then counsel argued that the lender in this case had no cause of action because it didn't provide a proper notice of cure. And that's simply contrary to the language of the statute.
Well, one of the things that's advancing is there is no right to accelerate unless a valid notice of right to cure.
I'll get to that in just one moment, if you don't mind. Continuing to look at 425.103 before we get to that section you're raising, Your Honor, 425.103.3 provides a cause of action which...
Just a minute. Slow down.
I'm sorry.
Where in 425.103.3.
Three.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
And this is in our supplemental yeah. appendix. So 425.103.3 provides a cause of action with respect to the obligation of a customer in a consumer credit transaction shall be subject to this subchapter, including the provisions relating to notice of cure.
Mm-hmm.
So a cause of action exists once the customer falls into default. The language of 425.103 provides that the procedures, including the notice of cure procedures, are an overlay on that cause of action that does exist. So connecting for a second back to...
This is so much law. It all depends on how wide your lens is or how narrow your lens is. Your opposing counsel would say there is no right to... And this was picked up earlier on questioning. There is no right to file a lawsuit unless there has been a valid... notice of right to cure.
Well, and I would say that it's not, the question is not whether you have a right to file a lawsuit. If you look at, if we turn to 425.105, which you had asked about, the provision that we're talking about with the notice of cure, it provides procedural prerequisites to suit. The way 425.105.1 is written is that a merchant may not accelerate the maturity of a consumer credit transaction, may not commence any action unless the merchant believes the customer to be in default, and then only upon the expiration of 15 days after a notice is given pursuant to 425.104.
The notice of right to cure.
Yeah. Right. And those, as they're worded, do not give rise to a cause of action, and the customer, they are procedural prerequisites that you need to check off this box and this box before filing
it's
suit.
It's just a matter of lens. You can interpret it either way. You can say there is no cause of action, that exists unless the prerequisites are met. That's the response of your opposing.
That's contrary to the words of the statute. It says there's a cause of action if there's a default. 425.103 says a cause of action arises if you're in default. The only way that cause of action goes away is if you've paid off, you've made good on your default, and the default no longer exists, or for some reason the loan becomes invalid or is discharged by operation of law. But and we should turn back to 427.104.1J, because it says you're pursuing a right that does not exist. The cause of action under the debt exists as soon as the customer is in default.
I want to focus. I was reading within the last couple of days. Thomas Jefferson said of John Marshall that he engages in twistification. I really like that. I'm not sure what it meant, but I knew I liked it. And I want to take a look at the big picture here. And the big picture is if voluntary dismissal is the remedy, then the right to have a private attorney general, which underscores all consumer legislation and regulation, whether it's under consumer protection under 100.18 to 100.20, or whether it's under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, the right to have a private attorney general is so important. And all of that underpinnings is eviscerated if the only remedy is, oh, voluntary dismissal. That concerns me. Can you address
that? I understand where you're coming from, and that is applicable to some sections of the WCA. But in this case, the legislature has specifically chosen to word 425.105 as a procedural prerequisite to suit. In contrast to other sections of Chapter 425, for example, the repossession section, where it has big and gnarly teeth to enforce the requirement that you provide a notice of repossession before you do self-help repossession. So the legislature has decided when the provisions of the WCA are so important that they need to give rise to a violation under the WCA, or they need to give rise to a violation and the biggest penalty, which is the jackpot penalty for repossessions, which is the loan is voided, you get your money back, and you get to keep the collateral. But coming back to 425.105, this does not implicate the private attorney general issue, because the private attorney general issue arises to when a customer is suing to recover for a violation of the WCA. You only get attorney's fees if there's a violation of the WCA, and that was held in community credit and also later by the Court of Appeals in the credit acceptance versus Woodard.
What does your buddy Ed Heiser say about this?
Well, he agrees. We work together. So anyway, he didn't disagree with anything I had in my brief, but I do have the expert on it. So if he didn't agree with me.
Now, maybe I didn't read carefully enough, but I didn't see it cited.
Which one?
Ed Heiser.
Oh, I think usually consumer lawyer cite Ed.
Yeah.
We have Ed on the front of our brief. So, but to back.
I haven't read that Marquette Law Review article. I'm going to take a contradiction of that Marquette Law.
Oh, no, it does. It doesn't. But to come back to the issue of, I understand your question about, I think to some extent, is this fair? Is this right? Does this cause customers unnecessary cost or inconvenience? And in this case, the argument that Mr. Kirsch has no quote-unquote remedy or recourse is just untrue. And when a lender or any plaintiff moves to voluntarily dismiss after issue is joined, the court can condition the dismissal on the payment of costs, which includes attorney's fees. The Dunn versus Michelson case holds that.
The statutory attorney fees are actual?
The parties would argue about that. I would say that it's not. It's attorney's fees for 805.04 in the Dunn case, and it would not be attorney's fees under 425.308. And we would argue from our perspective, if the issue were at issue, which it isn't in this case, that the customer shouldn't get 100% of their attorney's fees. Potentially, they should get attorney's fees that were wasted by having the action filed and then dismissed. Because some of the fees incurred, if you're going to refile the action after sending a notice of cure, wouldn't have been wasted. The other issue in this case is, even though Mr. Kirsch did not ask for damages, for costs and attorney's fees as a condition to voluntary dismissal, which he could have under 805.04, there's another protection for customers who are in this situation when you have a voluntary dismissal, which does sometimes occur. The protection is under 805.04. If the plaintiff files another lawsuit on the same claim, but say the issue of costs and attorney's fees wasn't raised, there wasn't an award. If in this case Security Finance files another lawsuit on the same claim, then the borrower has the right to argue to the court that he or she should award the costs of the prior action. And so that's a protection against a plaintiff from repetitively filing lawsuits and causing the defendant unnecessary costs. So in this case, that is a nice protection. What we have here is not a violation of 427.1041J because the you have a right, you have a cause of action under the contract for payment because there's a default. That didn't go away. There's no allegation they weren't in default. There's no allegation they were paid in full. The only allegation is that the notice of cure wasn't provided that meets the requirements of the statute.
And is that not a violation of 425.104?
I don't agree that it's a violation because 425.104 and 105 don't provide for a violation. And if you compare it to the other sections of Chapter 425, the fact that the legislature worded 425.105 as prerequisites to suit and didn't provide that they give rise to a violation is notable because what's in a statute is just as important as what's not in a statute.
Yeah. So I look at 425.302 sub 2, and it says, this section also applies to all violations for which no other remedy is specifically provided.
And that begs the question, is this a violation? And we argued in our brief that it's not a violation.
I don't know why it's not a violation. Right? I mean, there is a requirement set forth by the statute that Security Finance did not follow. Why is that not a violation of that requirement?
As the wording of 425.105.1 goes, it says a merchant may not accelerate or commence an action unless they do A, B, and C. If they don't do A, B, and C, they haven't met the procedural prerequisites to suit. And as case law has applied the statute, that's grounds to dismiss.
The statute... Hang on.
Go ahead.
They didn't follow the requirements of 425.105, right? And
allegedly,
those are
yep.
prerequisites to filing the suit, and they filed the suit anyway. How is that not a violation of the obligation to check those marks off before you file a suit?
It is a failure to satisfy procedural prerequisites, but it's...
You could say that of any statutory provision in here.
Well,
if you don't follow the statutory requirement, you could say, well, that's not a violation. It's just a failure to follow what it required.
Well, I think the way this legislature has worded 425.105.1 is significant as compared to the rest of Chapter 425 and other provisions of the WCA. Other provisions of the WCA where the legislature felt that teeth or right to remedy are important provide that. We use the word violation in the section. This statute doesn't use the word violation, and as such, it doesn't give rise to a claim for violation.
So if the legislature did not specifically state in each statutory provision, thou shalt not violate this statute, that means it can't be violated?
No, it means that there's no claim for violation of it, especially in this case where it's worded as a procedural prerequisite on the lender to comply before filing a lawsuit. It's akin to a notice of claim if a person has been injured by a state actor or a municipality. They have to give a notice of claim and give a certain amount of time before filing a lawsuit. So it's a procedural prerequisite to suit that for certain reasons. And if it's not given, it's grounds to dismiss.
So give me the best statutory provision relating to violation where it says this can give rise to damages. What's your best example of that?
Well, and many different provisions in the WCA, and we cited them in our brief, include a violation is subject to, and then they cite to the 425 remedies.
Right,
others,
that's, right.
And then others.
425.302 says if it's not otherwise provided, here's the one that you use.
And every instance of not complying with the WCA does not give rise to a violation.
Okay. So
because
there,
of the way that the legislature chose to word the statute.
Is there any violation of the Chapter 425 to which 425.302 applies in which that statutory section did not call out, according to your terms, this is a potentially sanctionable term if you don't follow it? What would you point to?
There are a few sections that cite to 425.302 as their remedy, if that's your question.
My question is 425.302 sub 2 presupposes that there will be statutory sections that you might violate that give rise to damages where they don't call out a 425 remedy.
Right. Right? I agree with that.
So where would I find one of those?
There are provisions of the WCA that don't use the word violation,
mm-hmm.
and that, for example, in Chapter 421, the section about choice of law provisions,
let's stick with 425, because that's what 425.302 applies to. So 302 sub 2 presupposes there will be parts of this chapter that would be violated, but which do not call specifically for a 425 violation. And so 302 is your default remedy. So give me an example in 425 where that would be the case.
Well, 425.103 doesn't set forth a violation, doesn't say a violation of the section. There is a violation of the section, or it's subject to a particular remedy. That doesn't mention the word violation. 425.104, of course, doesn't mention a violation. 425.105 doesn't mention a violation. Let's see. And there are other provisions, like 425.106 says an order or process in violation of the section is void. So some sections spell out consequences if there is if something is in violation of the section. Unconscionability allows a judge to hold a loan agreement to be unenforceable under the terms of unconscionability as a defense. I wouldn't call that exactly a violation, but that's more of a equitable defense under 425.107.
Yeah. So out of the list you've given me, pick one that would be subject to the remedy of 425.302 sub 2.
I don't know that any of them. Well, let me see. There may not be any in Chapter 425. That doesn't mean that the section is superfluous.
Why not?
Because that section is there in the event that the legislature adopts additional statutes, imposes additional obligations for which a violation is spelled out but no remedy is stated. The legislature does amend the WCA from time to time, and regulations can be implemented as well.
So your suggestion is that 425.302 sub 2 exists because the legislature thought, you know what, we got all the bases covered right now. Maybe sometime down the road, we're going to adopt something and we're not going to say anything about a remedy, and so we're going to put this in here to cover that kind of eventuality.
It's a backstop or a catch-all if the legislature doesn't think to tie the violation to one of the sections of 425.302.
So as the chapter exists today, you can't point to any of its provisions to which 425.302 sub 2 would apply?
Some sections apply 425.302 affirmatively.
Right,
but because they do, two doesn't come into play.
All right, so I just want to make sure I understand your answer. So you would say that as Chapter 425 stands today, there are no provisions to which 425.302 sub 2 would apply?
I'm not sure about that. In this case, in the Court of Appeals, we argued that there is no violation of Chapter 425.104 from the failure to give a notice of cure, that the consequence of it is dismissal of the action as the statute is written. The reply brief of Mr. Kirsch didn't respond to that and say, no, it is a violation. So we showed in all of our briefs that it doesn't constitute a violation, citing various provisions of the WCA, both Chapter 425 and elsewhere, to show when the legislature chose to define something to be a violation or chose to define other consequences, like the term is invalid, or like with repossession, if you don't give a notice of repossession, then you're entitled to the big remedy for failing to repossess after giving a notice.
So
the legislature spells out when something is so significant that it gives rise to a violation or some other recovery.
So is the term violation, is that a term of art in this chapter?
It's It's a term the legislature specifically chose to signify when noncompliance with a provision gives rise to the right to recovery in a customer. So is it a term of art? I would say it was a term that was specifically used intentionally by the legislature. I don't think the meaning of violation is really controverted, but the fact that it is used or it's not used is significant.
Counsel, I want to return to my private attorney general concern. You indicated that it's really not implicated here, but at least I get solace from the brief of legal aid that says it most certainly is implicated here. And it's implicated because, as this brief advances, that there has to be someone to vindicate rights. And it goes through the CCAP and listing that, of course, what they know and other debt collection authorities that they cite, that most of the time these cases are taken by default. They indicate that your client had 2,700 filings. I don't know the number of those that ended in default. They did say, though, in the last 2 years that this case, Mr. Kirsch's case, is the only case that had an attorney. That's what they say here.
You mean, anyway, that's neither here nor there, and it's not in the record. The fact that...
I guess they're asking us to take judicial notice since they're citing the CCAP stuff. They don't actually say judicial notice. They give some of the statistics citing two treatises and other stuff to CCAP. So my concern is this, that... if voluntary dismissal is the only remedy, then what incentive is there for any attorney to take a case to act as a private attorney general, which is, as I indicated before, really a bedrock to consumer protection actions? There's no incentive for a private attorney to get involved if voluntary dismissal is the only remedy.
Well, that's putting the cart before the horse, or the tail wagging the dog, or some metaphor like that.
Maybe it's twistification. Maybe
yeah, it could be. But the incentive for lenders, because there has been mention that there's no incentive for lenders to comply, which is kind of the other side of what you're arguing or what you're asking
That's right.
about.
I'm talking about how it shows up on CCAP, and of course we hear and they cite to authorities about people not getting employment because even if it's dismissed, it's still on CCAP for 2 years in small claims cases. Landlord tenants check up on CCAP, you know, this sort of stuff. And so this is a real problem to their clients at Legal Aid, they say.
Well, there is no prohibition in the WCA from filing a lawsuit. The incentive for the lenders do not want to go to court to get paid. They want to get paid by their customer and continue their relationship. They do so by sending notices, sending letters, keeping in contact, sometimes making telephone calls. Lender's incentive is to get paid. The incentive is to send a notice of cure to try to bring the customer in compliance and up to date on their loan. The filing a lawsuit is costly and time-consuming for lenders. So there is not it doesn't drive the lender to file lawsuits to get paid. It's the last resort. And so I mention just one thing. My light is on. The backstop to this notice of cure issue, when you have the question of a default judgment with a lender suing on a debt, is the 425.109 provision, which provides that you need to include certain information in the complaint so the customer knows why they're in default and how much they owe. And 425.109.3 provides that the judge cannot enter default judgment on the complaint if that information is not provided. So that section does provide some measure of protection for customers who are sued and don't have a lawyer, or sued and don't appear or are in default.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Rebuttal.
She's waiting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please, I said rebuttal. I thought you would begin, but you may begin at your pleasure.
I wasn't sure if I should proceed. You looked like you were
I'm going to ask you a question, so I was looking at the section of the statute. So.
Then I better start talking before you get to that.
That's right. There you
go. I want to touch on something that was just finished up on, the idea that lenders do not want to go to court to get paid. I have other things I wanted to talk about, but this is one of the most important. Lenders absolutely want to go to court, and there's very little barrier to them going to court. In small claims case, which is where the vast majority of these cases are, security finance can appear by a non-attorney full-time employee. The filing fee is only $95. Many counties allow service by mail, thereby making it less likely debtors will understand the significance of the lawsuit in the first place. Once a judgment is entered, a creditor has a whole host of rights that do not exist pre-judgment, including the right to garnish wages, the right to garnish bank accounts, and, most significantly, the right to have a bench warrant issued if a customer does not, by 15 days after the notice of default or after the default is given, provide all of their financial information under oath. Small claim statutes require a debtor against whom a judgment was entered to swear under oath as to all their financial assets and to provide that to the court and the creditor within 15 days of the entry of the default judgment. The failure to do that can and does frequently allow circuit courts to issue bench warrants for arrest against debtors. So a debtor who might be only $200 behind on their payment, who is illegally sued without a proper notice of right to cure default, may within 30 days find themselves with a bench warrant against themselves. A debtor might be pulled over for having a taillight out and be arrested on that, and that has absolutely happened, that debtors have been arrested for not complying with that. This is a very, very serious thing that goes far beyond simply having your name online, which is bad enough for many people.
I was very interested in opposing counsel's tying Chapter 425 to 427, seeing where it fit and where it didn't. And the part that interested me most was 425.103 sub 3, where it talks about a cause of action with respect to a consumer credit obligation, and that is set out earlier in 425.103. And its subject, it says, to 425.104 and 105. And her argument was, it shows that a cause of action may be filed, but the cause of action is conditioned on the criteria of those sections. And I think your argument was basically there was no right at all to file the cause of action, but I think you both agree your client was in default, right? You're not disagreeing on that point.
I don't necessarily agree that our client was in default, because the notice of right to cure default that he received was not necessarily clear as to what the default was.
I was looking at the definition of default under the statute.
Correct. He has to be at least two payments behind within 1 year.
Yep.
Now, it was never proven in this case that he was in default, and we don't know for sure what the claim default was, because, again, the notice was unclear as to what the default was, and the complaint itself didn't even contain the word default. When Mr. Kirsch was sued, the complaint demanded a dollar amount, appended a copy of the contract, and said literally nothing else. So when you talk about the pleading requirements and when you talk about the purposes of the Consumer Act, Mr. Kirsch was given no information by which he could even ascertain whether the pleading against him was correct. And if you refer to the notice of right to cure default, which did not contain all the statutory information, he's even further in the dark.
Well, he would know whether he was behind on his payments. He had the contract before him, and it showed him the dates on which the payments were due, right?
Well, Mr. Kirsch would have the contract before him and would probably know when his payments were made. But as a practical matter, if Mr. Kirsch believes he made his payments and Security Finance, for whatever reasons, believes he doesn't and files a lawsuit against him, the complaint against Mr. Kirsch gave no indication as to what Security Finance felt he had done wrong.
Okay, well, I'm still trying to stick to the complaint before us and the contract that was appended to the complaint. Okay, so he would know if he was in default or not, correct?
Mr. Kirsch would know if he had made all of his payments, but he would not know if Security Finance had declared a default. And Security Finance is not required to declare a default. So if Mr. Kirsch misses two payments, or misses a payment in March and misses a payment in November, which would qualify as a default, he may not be aware that Security Finance believes he's in default. If he then goes in and makes his December payment, he's still in default by the technicalities of the law. But he may not be aware that Security Finance intends to enforce that by accelerating the transaction. So again, Mr. Kirsch is entitled, before a lawsuit is served on him, to be told, Security Finance believes you're in default. You have 15 days to either cure the default or take some other action, at which point he could contact Security Finance and tell them he doesn't believe he's in default or pay up and avoid a lawsuit. And that's, in fact, required also by the contract. To touch on Justice Kelly's earlier comments, I looked at the contract. The contract expressly requires a notice of right to cure default under 425.105. It makes a specific reference to that statute. So Security Finance...
So does the section that I was trying to get you to talk about, sub 3, but that's fine. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay. Well, this is... Consumer credit actions are always sticky. You know, you both did a very good job, and the briefs were very good. So we appreciate your bringing it to our attention. We haven't done one for a while. And certainly it's an ongoing concern for the public. So thank you very much. We are now going to adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:05. We are adjourned.